Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 7th of June, these are our main stories. Evacuations are continuing in parts of southern Ukraine as the flood from the dam burst spreads.
But it's already clear that it will have grave and far-reaching consequences for thousands of people on both sides through the loss of homes, safe water and livelihoods.
Pope Francis is in a hospital in Rome for abdominal surgery. We hear from our correspondent there. We're talking about trust. A report tells us where in the world trust levels are highest and lowest. You may be surprised with the findings. Also in this podcast, is there someone alive today who will live to 150? We speak to two scientists who have bet on that, one of the most lucrative wagers ever. But neither of those who made it will be alive to collect the payoff. Let's start in Ukraine and the aftermath of the dam breach in the south of the country. Waters are said to be receding in the town of Novokakhovka, just downstream of the dam. Further south, they're still on the rise. Satellite pictures show grain silos and entire villages underwater. Elsewhere, houses were ripped from their foundations and seen floating down the river Dnipro. Thousands of people have been evacuated so far, but it's the long-term impact of the flooding that's of concern too. Here's the United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths speaking at the UN Security Council in New York.
The sheer magnitude of the catastrophe will only become fully realised in the coming days. But it's already clear that it will have grave and far-reaching consequences for thousands of people in southern Ukraine on both sides of the front line through the loss of homes, food, safe water and livelihoods.
Oleksiy Goncharenko is a Ukrainian MP. He told us what the situation was like across the affected region.
Thousands of hectares of land is under the water and thousands of houses are destroyed. Dozens of villages and towns are damaged. So it's a real, real catastrophe. And all this, what I told you, is just a short-term consequences, but also long-term consequences will be huge damage to the environment for years ahead.
Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams is in Ukraine and told me more.
Well, I think if you bear in mind that this all emanated from that collapsed dam at Novokakhovka, then it is perhaps the case now that up there, close to the dam, the floodwaters may now have started to recede. Although, don't forget that there is a vast reservoir behind that dam that is that has to empty as a result, and it's all coming through a narrow gap where the dam has been demolished. And so that huge lake, which was as much as 14 kilometres across and 100 kilometres long, that all is now emptying into the Black Sea. And in order to get to the Black Sea, it has to go down through the last stretch of the Dnipro River. And that is why those communities on either side of the river have been completely inundated, particularly bad flooding on the Russian side, where, generally speaking, the ground is a little bit lower than on the other side. But further down in Kherson, where James is, it is likely that we will still see some rise in the floodwaters as this huge volume of water makes its way down to the sea. Some of the pictures from Kherson this morning are pretty dramatic. Some neighbourhoods, particularly around the junction of the Dnipro and Koshevo rivers, are essentially underwater. You can see rooftops, but not much more. So in some parts of Kherson, down at river level, the situation is pretty dramatic, and that's why we're seeing this rescue operation continuing.
And I was mentioning earlier on pictures of grain silos pretty much underwater, and Martin Griffiths, the UN humanitarian chief, was saying, look, it's all about livelihoods as well in the medium to long term. This is a real problem, isn't it? And it could affect grain production because of lack of irrigation waters. It's far-reaching, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, I think, you know, obviously the immediate humanitarian implications look and are dire in terms of people, you know, sitting on their roofs, having to evacuate flooded homes and so forth. We have not, by the way, heard much in the way of casualty reports. I assume that some people will have been killed as a result of this horrendous flooding, but we're not hearing those reports yet. But you're right, the long-term consequences are potentially extremely grave, and Ukrainian officials are beginning to highlight those. The Dnipro River and that reservoir, the Kakhovka Reservoir, were hugely important for a number of reasons. One, the provision of drinking water to a huge chunk of southern Ukraine, and also, equally important, perhaps more important, the supply for the entire irrigation system in what is essentially the most fertile agricultural land in Ukraine. And the government is warning that that system, which provided irrigation, they say, for 500,000 hectares, has been absolutely wrecked by this, and that as a result, we will see in the coming year or two that some fields in the Kherson region will, in the words of the statement we were reading this morning, be turned into deserts.
Paul Adams. Data, in many ways, rules our lives. So when your personal data is stolen, it is very worrying indeed. In our last edition of the Global News Pod, we reported on a massive data breach affecting payroll data from companies including British Airways and the BBC. Now, a notorious cybercrime gang called Clop has claimed it's behind that cyber attack. The hackers have posted their demands on their darknet site. Here's our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy.
Every organisation has different information that's been hacked. The way that most of the kind of household name organisations that we're talking about, so British Airways, BBC, Aer Lingus, even the Nova Scotia government in Canada, they've all been hacked through a company called Zealous. So Zealous used this little piece of software called MoveIt, and the hackers got into MoveIt, therefore they got into Zealous, and they got into all these other organisations' payroll systems. So it depends on what your organisation payroll holds on you. In some cases, unfortunately, it is bank details. So British Airways have said that some of their staff have had their bank details stolen. As an individual, it is frightening because, of course, this can lead to potential identity theft. People could try and take out accounts in your name with some of these details. There are unfounded fears, though, that this could lead to your bank account being drained or something. That, according to the experts, simply isn't going to happen. There are so many steps between now and that happening that the hackers will have to take. There will be secondary attacks where they email you to try and convince you to give over more details, or there'll be a phone call where they try and convince you that they are the bank or something like that. So individuals are being asked at the moment not to panic and basically to just be vigilant of any activity. The reality is, though, these crews are working to try and make as much money as quickly as possible in as easy a way as possible. They haven't got time or resource to go through and attack individuals that are caught up in this. They've given an ultimatum to all the victim organisations affected saying, interestingly, they're saying you need to get in touch with us if you've been affected by this by the 14th of June. Otherwise, we'll start publishing the data online. And what they're hoping to do is scare companies around the world that have been affected by this into getting in touch with them and beginning the negotiation on how much they'll pay. And the advice, as ever, is not to pay these criminals.
And do companies around the world pay up? Yeah. Is that why they think, well, OK, it's worked before, it'll work again?
Yeah, ransomware is really good business. There are companies around the world that get hit all the time. Clop has been doing this for many years. We think the gang are based in Russia, because they operate in Russian-speaking forums and they take breaks during Russian holidays. But the hackers could be anywhere around the world. But they can't be stopped because they're so well funded, because companies are paying. Because, of course, sometimes these ransomware attacks can bring companies to their knees.
And, Joe, a broader question. Who's winning the hacking battle? Or is it a case that it's a constant race between both sides, defenders and attackers reacting to new developments?
I think if you'd have asked me that 6 months ago, I'd have said the hackers, because ransomware was a huge problem around the world. Companies were paying, they were being hit, there was data flooding all over the place. There have been real improvements in defences. Companies are taking this seriously now because there have been so many serious incidents where the organisations have either almost died or died in some cases. So I think things are getting better. I think security is improving, and I think that awareness is improving as well.
Joe Tidy. A day after the Vatican announced he was undergoing medical checks, Pope Francis has been admitted to hospital for abdominal surgery. The Pope, who's 86, arrived at Rome's Gemelli Hospital a few hours ago and is expected to spend several days there after this afternoon's operation. Our reporter Sofia Bettizza has more.
The Vatican says the Pope will have an operation on his abdominal wall while under general anaesthetic. He's expected to stay in hospital for several days to recover. Earlier today, Francis carried out his weekly audience as normal and didn't mention his planned operation. In 2021, he had part of his colon removed to try to ease a bowel condition, but recently revealed that the complaint had returned. The Pope spent 3 days in hospital at the end of March due to a respiratory infection, and last month he had to miss events because of a fever. But generally he has been considered to be in good health during his decade leading the Catholic Church, although persistent knee pain has meant he's increasingly used a wheelchair in recent years.
Sofia Bettizza. There was a famous bet made between two scientists in the year 2000. It was over whether there was already someone alive who would live to the age of 150. At that stage, life expectancy had only been increasing. It's doubled since 1841, but in recent years, it's been falling. So Sarah Montague caught up with the two professors who made that bet, Professors Stephen Orstad and Jay Olshansky. She started by asking Stephen to recap the history of the bet.
Someone asked me early in the 21st century when the first 150-year-old person would be alive. And I said I thought they were already alive. And that ended up being published. And Jay Olshansky read it and phoned me and said, "You don't really believe that, do you?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And so we decided to have this wager because you have to put your money where your mouth is. And so we each put $150 into an investment account to sit there for 150 years. And at that point, if one person had lived to be 150 years old and was still cognitively intact enough to carry on a conversation, then in the best case scenario, I would get all the accumulated money. More likely scenario, my descendants would get all the money. And if not, then Jay's descendants would get all the money. So that was the genesis of the bet and how it was constructed.
Now, Professor Olshansky, we should say you've since both doubled down on it, haven't you? Because we're now, more than two decades later. But at a certain point, you both said, "Hang about, I still hold firm to my belief."
Yes, of course. Now, not only did we double down, but we both have the exact same view that we had at the beginning of the century, which really, I think the scientific evidence each of us believes supports our own respective view.
I mean, in one sense, Professor Orstad, your position in some ways is quite logical because lifespan has been continuing. Professor Olshansky, why do you think it won't keep continuing?
Well, first of all, it hasn't been continuing. I mean, that's sort of the key thing is that I would also distinguish, by the way, between lifespan and life expectancy. So lifespan is how long an individual can live, and the world record for human longevity is 122. That has not changed since 1997 when the 122-year-old person died. No one's come close to 122 since then. There's no reason to expect that anyone, at least in the near future, is going to come close to 122. So we've already had a quarter century pass where nothing has happened to even come close to supporting Dr. Ostad's assessment. And even if we did develop some sort of intervention that could influence aging, we would have no way to prove that it could make somebody live to 150. We'd have to wait more than 100 years in all likelihood to get the answer. So I'm sitting in a very good position on this bet right now.
Do you agree with that, Professor Ostad?
No, of course I don't. I mean, we do agree on one basic thing, which is that sort of traditional advances in diagnosing and treating diseases are not going to get us to 150 years for some person. It's going to have to be an advancement that actually targets the underlying biology of aging. And since we made this wager, a lot has gone on. There's been just remarkable progress. When we made the bet, there was basically one or two possible ways to make a mammal, say a mouse, live longer. That was a level of dietary restriction that was totally impossible for humans to do, and a single gene that if you disabled it, it made the animals live much, much longer, but at the cost that they were dwarfed, they were infertile. But since then, we've done incredible progress. We now have 6 to 8 drugs that extend the life of a mouse that if it did so in a human would be more than enough for me to win my bet. We have brand new approach, which is reprogramming ourselves to be younger. And then we have these new blood transfusion paradigms where if you transfuse young blood into an old animal, it rejuvenates the brain and the muscles and the heart and all sorts of things. Now, none of these existed. And we didn't know anything about stem cells, really, when we made this bet.
Can I just ask you both, do you both want to live to 150?
If I remain cognitively intact and physically capable of doing the things I would like to do, absolutely. Life only gets more interesting.
Professor Olshansky?
Yeah, so I actually wouldn't put a number on 150. I just want to live as long as I can be healthy and cognitively intact, whether that's 100, 150, 200, and the number is completely irrelevant.
Jay Olshansky, and before that, Stephen Ostad. Still to come, Japan's parliament debates a landmark bill to redefine rape.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service that goes beyond the spin, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news. An honest explanation of the events shaping our lives. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Japanese parliament is debating a landmark bill to reform the country's sexual assault laws, which is only the second such revision in a century. Currently, Japanese law defines rape as sexual intercourse or indecent acts committed forcibly and through assault or intimidation, or by taking advantage of a person's unconscious state or inability to resist. Many other countries have a much broader definition. The most significant change will see lawmakers redefine rape from forcible sexual intercourse to non-consensual sexual intercourse, putting consent at the heart of it. Nuala McGovern heard more from Tessa Wong, the BBC's Asia digital reporter.
In most countries, you know, the very act of resisting or even saying no already means wasn't consent. And that would be defined as rape in most countries, but in Japan, it isn't. In Japan, the idea that sexual consent is not very well understood, very well defined, is actually proven in law, because a lot of cases where there has been rape, where I think in most other countries, it would be defined as rape, in Japanese courts, it's not considered as rape. And so there's been many cases where survivors have actually not found justice, even though they had clearly said no or had resisted. So the fact that they are changing this law, it's really quite significant. Activists have told me it sends a signal to Japanese society that no really means no. They're hoping that it changes the conversation. And also they hope that it would mean more survivors would be encouraged to come forward and to actually report the cases, and that more will see justice.
Do you think, that Japan instead is at this stage of the language and the terminology or really how you define it, the definition, being so narrow compared to other countries?
I think it's a process that other countries have kind of gotten to it first, but then Japan has lagged behind. sex consent is not very well taught. It's not taught a lot, even in schools. A lot of schools hesitate in using anatomical body parts to describe the act of sex itself. And in one infamous incident a few years ago, a group of educators with the Ministry of Education tried to introduce a consent module in sex education. And they found that they couldn't because they were told they couldn't actually describe the act of sex itself.
The euphemisms flowers or grass were used to try and explain sex education lessons?
I think that's the level of modesty in the way they want to talk about sex. And I think that has come to the detriment of understanding, you know, sex and sexual consent at an early age in Japan. And this is coupled with also, let's not forget, very easy access to porn and, you know, highly sexualized manga comics. And so this has kind of led to a very distorted sense of what sex is and what sex consent is, especially amongst younger Japanese.
The age of consent in Japan, it might surprise my listeners what it is. Do you want to tell us?
It's 13 years old, yes. It's very, very low. It's the lowest among the G7 group of countries, the world's richest democracies, yes.
Yes. And, I mean, has that been a point of debate as well?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the cases I wrote about where the case was thrown out of court because the girl was deemed as not having resisted enough, she was tried as an adult because she was 15 years old. So in the eyes of the law, she was considered an adult woman and it wasn't considered statutory rape. That in itself was also very problematic and another reason why she never saw justice.
That was Tessa Wong. And then there were 11. 11 people have now come out to say that they want to run for the Republican nomination for the US presidency. The latest contender is the former New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, and he entered the ring jabbing at the heavyweight favourite, Donald Trump. He said Mr. Trump was unfit for office. But what about Mr. Christie's credentials? Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes has the details.
Chris Christie is joining an ever-growing field of potential Republican nominees for the election next year. But I think unlike certainly all of the other candidates, and especially the man in the number two position, that's Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, he is still trailing behind Donald Trump, who is leading the pack. But unlike all of the others, Chris Christie is making it very clear that he is in this to stop Donald Trump. He's also in it to win it on his own account, but he's also in it, as he would say it, to expose the failings, as he would probably say, to expose the lies of Donald Trump, because this is a man that he knows very well. Chris Christie first stood potentially for the presidency in 2016. That was the year that Donald Trump eventually went on to be the winner. Chris Christie didn't do very well. He dropped out very quickly and joined Donald Trump. He was pretty much with him all the way through his time in the White House. But then after the January the 6th attack on Congress, that's when they parted company, with Chris Christie accusing Donald Trump of inciting the violence. And really, ever since then, as a political pundit on television, Chris Christie has been criticising every single move of Donald Trump.
Peter Bowes, now, how trusting are you? Well, an international survey on just how much people trust each other has found real variations across the globe. You might expect that. Well, research from the World Values Survey found that nearly three quarters of Norwegians, for example, and almost two thirds of Chinese people believe most people could be trusted. But just 5% of those in the Philippines and Indonesia take a similar view. Earlier, I spoke to Valja Baraputri from the BBC's Indonesian service about the country's low ranking when it came to trusting one another.
Quite surprising for me, because I thought we trust each other, and now I found myself having less trust with each other with this survey result.
So you'd gone through your life up until now thinking, oh, well, yes, I can leave my door open, or I trust that if I give somebody a lift in my car, that then everything will be fine. How have you gone about life up until now?
Well, after you said that, I realized that maybe we don't trust each other, because I don't do any of that here.
What kind of examples can you think of now that you know that Indonesia is at the bottom of this list for trust? How does it show itself?
I think I keep my circle pretty small, and I think I trust my circle. But I think, for example, people have to think again before sharing anything on social media, for example, because anything that you put on social media can be screenshotted. And then anything in Indonesia that goes viral can fire back at you. So I think that is one example of how we don't trust each other. And I think I observe from my personal experience over the years that I share less and less on social media. I also filter my friends on social media more diligently over the years, because there are examples of things that go viral in the public that was taken from personal level engagement, like friends.
Absolutely.
Or family.
I suppose these are things that affect countries around the world, people having less trust because of social media. But is there anything specifically about Indonesia which means that people are less trustworthy, do you think?
From my observation, we are not very openly communicative with each other. We tend to close up. We tend to not express our opinions because we're afraid that people will judge us. I think that is just Indonesians being Indonesians.
Valdia Baraputri there. A decorative wood carving dug up by chance during some building works has been found to be the oldest ever discovered in Britain. The piece of oak, which is around about a metre long, was preserved in a layer of peat, and it's thought to date back around about 6,000 years. It was unearthed in a village in southern England. Jill Campbell, who runs the Historic England Lab, where it's now being kept, told Amal Rajan how it was found.
It was a real chance find. Derek Forser said, who's a retired neurological surgeon and a kind of keen archaeologist and lives in the village of Boxford. He was basically building a garage workshop. When they were doing the foundations, they came across a layer of peat. They pulled out this piece of timber, didn't really think anything of it. He thought he might use it because he's a wood carver. So they then did the foundations and they hosed off the timber and noticed these markings on the timber, these grooves and carvings. And he realised it might be something special and then immediately called the local archaeologists and said, look, you know, we think we've got something special here. What should we do next? The county archaeologist then called Historic England for advice. And we said, well, keep it cold, keep it wet. And if you can get us a sample, we'll try and identify what wood type it is so that we could start the process of investigation.
And what do the carvings show? What do the markings show? What do they look like?
There's a series of kind of parallel kind of grooves, notches, at least 10. And then there are other kind of like circles and dots and things like that. So an abstract pattern, which is very similar to what we see on the earliest Neolithic pottery from Britain.
Fascinating. What's the what do you think is the significance of this find? How much does it add to our understanding of the period?
The important thing is that wooden objects don't normally survive. Now, we have tools from much earlier, but we don't have these big pieces. It's over a metre long, but normally they just don't survive because they would just rot away. So we have very little idea of how Mesolithic people used wood, and very little kind of Mesolithic art. So although this is in some ways a fragment and we only have a little bit of the decoration, it gives us that insight into Mesolithic people and how they decorated things and how they kind of lived and their relationship with wood.
What did they use these wood carvings for?
We don't really know. We suspect that these things might actually have been, if you can imagine them set upright, for example, or set so where they were visible, they could have been markers of special places. You could even say that it might be a marker for a way. So we think this was in a wetland environment,
right?
Because of the peat. So it may have been on the boundary of the wet and the dry and be showing you a route through or a place where you would gather.
That was Jill Campbell. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa. And the producer was Vanessa Heaney. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Claire Graham.
And I'm the BBC World Affairs editor, John Simpson.
And we'd like to tell you about a new podcast from the BBC World Service, The Explanation.
The Explanation looks beyond the headlines, bringing you in-depth analysis of the stories affecting our lives.
Whether it's important, long-running issues,
or the latest global events,
we're making sense of the big stories
and giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.